Did you set your clocks ahead an hour? Jackie Quinn tells us more.
If you forgot to spring forward overnight, you might be an hour late for today's activities. As of 2 a.m. this morning, daylight saving time is back. Although we lose an hour of sleep, we gain an extra hour of daylight. The time change wasn't observed in Hawaii, most of Arizona, or Puerto Rico. Daylight saving time will end November 2nd. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Eastern Kentucky is one of the first teams into the NCAA men's basketball tournament, winning the Ohio Valley Conference's automatic bid with a 79-73 victory over Belmont in the conference tournament championship game. Elsewhere in top 25 action, top-ranked Florida rolled over Kentucky. Number 2 Wichita State remains unbeaten, running its record to 33-0. And number 4 Duke cruised past North Carolina. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Everybody get ready for Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. A foodie born and bred, my wife Nikki loves chatting up chefs, dining out, and insider industry buzz.
And my husband David thinks a great meal is nothing but a good burger, a frosty brew, and a check for under $20. Because he is cheap.
Well, maybe so, but Foodie married Beast anyway, and together we've got the food and wine variety show that has everyone talking.
It's Foodie and the Beast, and we are on now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis on what finally is a reasonably acceptable Sunday.
Yeah.
No snow, no ice.
Not yet.
No, nothing. Not yet. We've got a great show. We're taking some different tacks today. We're not, you know, we're kind of out there in the world talking about the world of food, but not necessarily about food per se. Lauren Winter and Brian Miller are the co-founders, I guess, of Edit Lab at Street Sense. They're restaurant architects, and we're in talking about really how they conceptualize. They walk into a raw space and figure out how to make it look, sound, feel like the restaurant. They've done El Rey, which recently opened, the Gibson, Red Hen.
Yes.
Which is close to Lauren's heart because she and her husband, Sebi Zutant, own it. Hank's on the Hill and many others. So we're going to be talking to them.
And later in the show, Jordan Harris is back in studio. You know him as the winemaker at Terrera Winery. But he's got something new he wants to talk about today. It's called Boneyard. We're going to be tasting it in studio and finding out all about it.
I like that. And Amanda Moniz is a PhD. She's a historian and former chef at a number of bakeries and restaurants, including Mario Batali's Babbo in New York and Mark Furstenberg's Breadline here. And she's figured out how to dovetail her passion for baking and her passion for American history. She also has a PhD in American history.
I'm not going to be a part of this conversation. And her are just going to be talking the entire time. Like, I'm out.
She's going to be teaching a class at the Hill Center in June called Civil War Sanitary Fair Cookbooks. And, you know, we'll get into it when Amanda comes online. Mm-hmm. But it's about a whole, really, a revolution during the Civil War in how to focus on sanitary conditions for wounded soldiers and, more importantly, how to raise money and get civilians involved in that process. Did I do that? Reasonably well. God bless you, my child. Am I doing? I'm talking about Michael too. Okay. Well, March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and Michael Sapienza is with us. He's the executive director of Chris for Life, they're involved in a whole, month-long a series of activities to raise awareness about colon cancer and what you should do to protect yourself. And we're going to be doing – this is really great. He's got a thing he started, last year called Love Your Butt?
Hashtag Love Your Butt.
And Nikki, I love your butt.
All right.
But we're going to be doing some colon cancer trivia and gosh.
And moving on from there.
Okay.
But let's get the party started. We're starting the show today. Speaking of El Rey, which is why Edit is in here, Edit Lab. El Rey is a new restaurant that just came out in D.C. And we've got their beverage manager, Brendan Murphy. He's in the studio with us today. Hey, Brendan, how are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So now you're the beverage manager for 9 restaurants.
8 right now.
8?
One effectively got taken off my plate. Thank goodness.
Why? Because it was just too much for you?
It was a little bit too much.
The 9th one?
It was a little bit too much. My threshold is 8.
So El Rey, Why don't you tell us what restaurants you are, since I don't know which one.
I started at the Gibson a little over 5 years ago, and I tended bar there for about 3 years.
Okay.
And then Eric and Ian Hilton asked me to count their beans. So I did Marvin. I do Marvin, Patty Boom Boom, what is now Den of Thieves, Brixton, Satellite Room, American Ice Company, El Rey, and I think that's, is that it? Is that eight?
That's good
it sounded
enough.
Like eight to us.
And I did the first menu at Shea Billy, which is up on Georgia Avenue.
Yep. Okay, cool. So how do you, since you have all these different restaurants and they're all very different styles, how do you come up with a beverage program that reflects each of them?
Working at the Gibson worked a lot with classics, so try and start from there because, quite frankly, over about 150 years ago and for the next few decades, some of the standards, the standard classics are pretty perfect if they're made correctly. So I usually start from there and hopefully get inspired from different things.
Have cocktails gone crazy? We've seen a couple of cocktail menus recently where, everything's in there but the kitchen sink. Are people just getting too frou-frou cute?
No. I think it's cleaner now,
don't you?
Yeah, I think if you're working with fresh ingredients and you use a jigger and you watch proportions, then there's a myriad of combinations that all taste good. So I think it's great the cocktails have taken off.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about the program at El Rey?
Sure. Started with the margarita, and people have been loving the margarita, and it's not, the 70s and 80s, the sour mix on the gun became fairly prevalent, but a real margarita is white tequila, is made from blue agave and Cointreau, an orange liqueur, real lime juice, and we use a little agave nectar to sweeten it up.
Okay, so are you making that next?
I can.
Okay,
right
terrific.
Now.
Right.
Not next, first.
First.
All right, so let's talk to Lauren Winter and Brian Miller of Edit Lab at Street Sense. Let's talk about how you guys met at the Savannah School of Design.
Yeah, Savannah College of Art and Design.
Yeah, I knew it was something like that. Savannah.
You knew it was Savannah.
We were down there, but we were inebriated the whole time we were there. So how
the to-go cups a lot.
So you literally, you met on the first day and said, let's be business partners?
That's pretty much how it happened.
Cool.
No, we went through a few studios together, and with that we met and started just kind of becoming friends, and I would bartend, and Brian would be probably my best patron. And we just got
along. That's a way to make a partnership.
Right.
You realize what she just inferred, Brian.
That's true.
Okay.
So, yeah, when we both happened to move up here and live in the same part of town and just kind of stayed friends our whole career, and probably about five years ago we started our firm together.
Let's talk about your careers. I mean, architecture is so vast. There's so many things you can do. How did you guys get into restaurant design?
I think I know why.
Well, I think with both of us, we were both people who really enjoyed bars, enjoyed restaurants. Lauren had bartended. I would go out and eat all the time, was friends with a bunch of bartenders, chefs. Mm-hmm. And really then the people that we knew who were kind of servers, back waiters, bar backs, moved up, became bartenders, moved up. So I said, well, I'm opening my own place now. And he said, well, we'll give you a little, we'll help you out a little bit, help lay out the bar. So it kind of just crept up and up as the people we knew kind of came up in the industry. We kind of came along with them. And at the same time, we were working at firms. I did some work for Core about a decade ago. So I did a little restaurant work there. But then really it was just through the network we had kind of made in D.C. As the people got their own spots, we kind of came up with them.
And as D.C. has exploded with restaurants, especially in the last, 10 years, how do you guys keep it fresh? I mean, with the spaces you're working with, there's a lot of new buildings, there's a lot of old buildings. How do you get inspired with the kind of work you're doing?
Well, we always try to make, the most important thing for us is to make the restaurant or bar feel not like our design, but to feel like the owners. So as new people come into the scene, as they're doing new places, really, if it reflects the personality of the owners, of the chefs, then it's going to feel different. It's going to feel successful.
So what do you do when you have an owner and, by their very nature of being entrepreneurs, their strong personalities, when you see them essentially walking off a cliff and not realizing it, where they want so much for the interior, but it really doesn't match what their vision is for the food or they say, I've got to have this or that. How do you handle them?
Well, we have, there's a good example of this. There's one client we're working with right now that we had gone down a road for design as he was looking at a space. And about a month ago, we realized the vision he was describing and where we were ending up with the space were two different things. And that was the sum of, 100 little decisions. But when we went and talked, we just had kind of a little, we met up at a bar one night at Right Proper and just sat down and had a little come to Jesus meeting and said, is this what you want? Is this really what you want? And said, well, I don't know. I want this. This is what we talked about the first day. Now what are we getting? And just kind of re-steering the ship and making sure that what they describe on the first day is where we end up, because as you develop a vision, it can really change. So you've got to make sure that you kind of have a mission statement that is rooted in something.
Well, I think that makes sense. Well, let's talk about El Rey specifically, because that is a really special place. I mean, you guys really went outside the box on that one. Is that your concept?
Well, let's talk about what the concept is.
Yeah, explain it first.
It's created out of shipping containers. We have five shipping containers total there, and they're a 9x40 shipping container. And really Eric Hilton came to us with the idea. It was originally supposed to be just an empty lot with maybe one shipping container on it that we did the beverages out of. And then as we kept proceeding with the plans and things got delayed in permit, it kept developing even further and enclosed this and retractable roof and really developed into what it is today. So having those shipping containers, one of the partners of the restaurant is a shipping company. So he had shipping containers, and that was part of how it developed between Eric Hilton and his partners.
It sounds so easy.
It was not easy at all. It was a very difficult process. And being that it's something very new and, you see it down at the yards, but it's not used in the same capacity. So the fact that it was something new really surprised DC and the permit office.
So were you just cutting them in half? I mean, can you talk about how you worked with them, the shipping containers?
Sure.
We're kind of carving them all up and shaping them, at different places. We would, cut different sections out to open them up so you could sit in them. Mm-hmm. And then we'd use those sections and paste them onto the front of the bar or try to build little bulkheads out of them and use them. But largely, we tried to really keep their dimensions and what they are there. We didn't want them just to be window dressing.
Okay.
It was a little bit difficult going into... All of U Street is a historic district, so meeting with the... DC Historic Office and saying, well, we want to build a new building out of shipping containers right on U Street. And so we had to have some hearings about that, but they were actually really excited about it and played along too.
I bet. Well, having been there, it's a very cool space. I mean, it's not like anything else in the city. Well, let's talk about some of the trends that you see happening right now in restaurants. What are some trends that you're tired of? Like, do people come to you? Is everybody still on Edison bulbs? Like, are you done with those? Like,
we're hoping not. Right. I mean, there's a time and place for them, but you are starting to see some of the same trends going on. And I think what we're looking to now with some of the clients that we have and what's happening in DC now, some of this, it's really interesting because it's a lot of the people we grew up with or bartended with or were younger with who are now opening their own places.
Right.
Or got married and are with their husband-wife team, realized they can open a restaurant. So what's coming up is going to be very different, I believe. And so it's important for us now to come up with something new and discover new trends. What I'm tired of is Edison bulbs. And,
right.
But I love them.
I love them too, but it's just they are in almost every...
Correct.
Not every restaurant, but, a lot of... What are some of the restaurants that you're seeing around town that you think are maybe up on a new trend or up on a design? Like, for a while, there was, those bubble lights. I just feel like you see several things that are the same in several restaurants.
Like the reclaimed wood.
Yeah, reclaimed wood.
Brian has a theory that we're going to start to make barns out of old restaurants.
Oh, my God, that's very funny. That won't be hard to do, actually. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'd love to hear about some of the new trends that you think are on the horizon and what are some of the projects you're working on that you're really excited about.
Great.
This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. I see a margarita in my future. We'll be back in just a sec.
At UPS, we take two things very seriously, your budget and our planet. It's why we've built one of the largest alternative fuel fleets in the industry. It's why we offer eco-responsible services like carbon-neutral shipping and carbon impact analysis. It's also why businesses trust UPS to provide customized solutions that cut costs and boost productivity. UPS is committed to helping you operate more efficiently and sustainably. Learn more at ups.com/gov.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
William is all too familiar with the dangers of being homeless in D.C. during the winter.
You'd be out there in the cold, you know, snowing, it would rain. You got to cover up, you'll freeze to death.
The threat of hypothermia and death is real for D.C.'s homeless. Your gift of just $10 right now will provide a winter rescue kit at Central Union Mission. That's warm clothes, blankets, and a hot meal. Give today at missiondc.org. That's missiondc.org.
Hey, Mom. Why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
And we are back on Foodie and the Beast. We're talking to Lauren Winter and Brian Miller of Edit Lab at Street Sense about restaurant design. And you were going to mention some of the things that you're seeing now in some of the restaurants that you think are sort of future trends.
Yeah, you know, the past few years we've been seeing a lot of, like you said, the Edison bulbs. It's the reclaimed wood everywhere, whitewash. And I think, you know, that was a reaction to a lot of the more modern hard edge restaurants, the color changing LEDs that we saw last decade.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think as people kind of get used to that, it's going to be, how do we kind of return to modernism, but with like a softer, really more comfortable feel? There's going to be a lot of more natural materials, but it's not going to be so much historical throwback anymore. It'll be moving into the future. And as part of that kind of comfortable aspect, we're definitely seeing a bigger focus from restaurateurs in terms of acoustics, you know, in terms of the comfort of seating, you know, really someplace you can spend a couple hours. Or if it's supposed to be someplace you're in and out, how does it work for 20 minutes and then make you want to leave?
Right. What are some of the projects you guys are working on now that are coming up?
We're working on, we got some exciting things coming down the pipeline. We've got El Camino coming up in Bloomingdale,
mm-hmm.
Which will be a little Mexican spot. It's exciting because we've done a lot of work in Bloomingdale. Lauren and Sebastian live around the corner, so it's always nice to do someplace we know we're going to be hanging out.
Sure.
We've got, I just got back yesterday from the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. I was down there with our client Jeremiah Langhorn, who's going to be doing an exciting project up here. Let's see, what else do we have in permit now? We're doing a permanent storefront for Taquerian, so the food truck going bricks and mortar down by the stadium will be great.
Mm-hmm. We have Arthur Ringel, who used to work at Hank's. He's going to open a spot at 517 H Street Northeast, so we're excited to see what he does with his food. And
yeah, it's nice to see kind of some more mature restaurants coming into the H Street area for sure.
Right.
That's so cool. And all those people moving up. How do we find you on the web and in real life if people want to get in touch with Edit Lab?
They can go. We've got a whole section at our firm's website at streetsense.com. There's a whole part of there called Edit Lab. You can look at all our work.
Cool.
Great.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure. When you sip on these margaritas. Brandon, awesome margarita.
Glad you like it.
Real good.
It is real good.
It makes a difference to use real lime. And you don't have to feel very bad about high fructose corn syrup.
Or any of that.
Right.
Well, so, I think that's why I think that I don't like margaritas, is because I think it's like I pucker up, like just thinking about it because of that mix.
Yeah, it's why we add a little bit of agave nectar. Truthfully, it's just white tequila, Cointreau, lime juice.
Now, is salt a must do for the classic margarita or not really?
I have to apologize. I should have brought some salt.
Oh my God,
no,
leave
salt and white tequila, especially unaged tequila, has got a certain amount of salinity. So a little bit of salt on the rim helps bring that out. And it's a very simple combination of flavors. You have orange, lime, you know, the herbaceous or the the fruitiness of the tequila, and one of the very few drinks that has lime. I'm sorry, that has salt.
Herbaceous is such a big word for Sunday
morning. I've got a lot of 50-cent
words. SAT word.
Son.
Let's talk about some of the other cocktails that you've put on the El Rey menu. Can you talk a little bit about El Rey and the kind of food they're serving there and how you made the cocktails to go with?
Sure. Tacos. Lots of tacos. And they're as perfect with, of course, margaritas. I have two takes on some sangria. One's a red. One's a white. Took some liberties. Not exactly sangrias, but I think they're pretty tasty. Mm-hmm. There's a michelada, which is tomato juice and lime with jalapenos and Cholula sauce and
salt. Your language.
I know. And spicy beer. Drinks.
And beer. Now you're talking my language.
Yeah. Okay. And so that's a nice breakfast, morning eye opener, or at 11 o'clock at night, and those seem to happen.
Well, what are you going to make next?
Make the red sangria next.
Excellent.
Cool. Yeah. All right. I'm ready. So, speaking of red and white, Jordan Harris is here. He's back. How many times have you been on the show?
We've been on a lot.
Quite a few.
We've been doing this for almost 6 years.
I refer to you as our Alec Baldwin, I think. But he's the winemaker at Terrera, and he's one of Wine Enthusiast's top 40 under 40 winemakers. Why don't you start off with a little bit, just to remind everybody of what Terrera is and offers.
Sure. Terrera is this neat little winery that started out actually 25 years ago. This is our 25th anniversary this year, so we're kind of excited about that. In Leesburg, we have just sort of grown as the Virginia wine industry has grown as well, to the point now that today we're just specialized very classic style, single vineyard blends, just a really fun winery, just aiming to make the very best stuff that we can.
I got a question for you. What does a winter like this winter do to your vines?
It makes me... You noticed that my hair was shorter. That's because it's starting to fall out.
No, that's because you cut it, you liar. Never try and BS a follically challenged person. That's cruel. Very cruel.
It's actually, it hasn't been too bad. We're right on the borderline of whether or not the cold was going to do anything. But I don't think we got cold enough to actually harm anything in the vineyard. So good moisture. So if we have a great hot summer and all that kind of stuff, then it'll be fantastic.
Okay.
Well, so now you guys have launched this other winery, Boneyard, which is why you're in today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, we were sitting around thinking, and we love Terrara. It's always going to be, the closest to our
heart. When you say who's we?
Well, there's...
The
same owners own both wineries, and, they've got me and pretty much all the management involved in both. But we were looking at it, and Terrara, it's so close to us, but it's so much fun. It's more classic, hands-off just, traditional winemaking. And then we thought, wine is changing so much, just like everything, food and beverage. If you look at the beer industry and how the craft brews are booming all over the place, and the food industry, the fusions, all that kind of stuff. We started looking and said, we need to do something with wine to keep us interested, keep us excited, and also keep people excited. Do something different that, matches where the world is going with food and beverage. So Boneyard is the idea behind the name is because we have an area just outside of our vineyard where we have old, decrepit, nasty tractors that have broken down, and that's our boneyard. It's like a graveyard for old equipment.
Okay.
And it's stuff that built us up and all that. So the idea behind Boneyard is everything that has sort of built us up and all of the history that has built up the wine industry to what it is today, but then kind of looking forward and saying, we learn from that, but we want to look at having a great time and do some interesting things, experiment, and create new history. With wine.
Well, let me hit you with a quote of yours. It said that these are a lot of wines that throw out the rule book and make wine more accessible, enjoyable, and approachable to everyone. What's that mean in English? Because, what's the reality of it? Are these like craft beer wines? Is that something?
In some cases, there are.
Craft wines.
Yeah.
I said craft beer. In other words, you're taking the craft beer approach where you're making these little fun little things that aren't necessarily fine wines, but are fun to drink.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
I know what I'm talking about.
It's right across the board with all of it. So, it's the first sparkling wine that we've worked on. And, everyone talks about Blanc de Blanc and Method Champenois and all that kind of stuff. And
I don't.
Well, Fair enough. Well, and that's why we created the style we did, which is in that traditional method. But we're like, listen, we want somebody to drink this on Tuesday. We don't want this to sit and wait till New Year's Eve. So it's bad to the bone bubbles. It's just kind of more fun. Then we've got one that skins. It's just a kind of different approach. It's a white wine fermented on its skins, which is technically called an orange wine. But they're not done very often.
So orange wine has become like a new buzzword. Lauren's husband, Sebastian Souton, serves orange wines at Red Hen. Yeah. And you're just seeing more and more of it. What's the allure of the orange wine?
Well, the original orange wines are just so funky and out there. The ones that, you know, are coming from.
That doesn't sound tasty, though. Are they tasty?
They absolutely can be. I mean, and it depends. I mean, a lot of them are more academic than they are anything else, and they have to be paired with food. It's not something that you would generally sit there and drink a bottle of because, mm-hmm. you know, some of them will have more oxidative, nutty kind of aromas. But they have this awesome structure with these cool white aromatics as well, where it can balance with many different foods. It can pair very, very well because it has the structure of some of the reds. So you can actually pair with the proteins and all that kind of stuff as well. There's sommelier's dream a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, they're tough to move in the first place. But we're playing with it and having a good time. We're okay. Using Arcatzitelli and variety, so.
All right. I'm going to move you to another subject, sort of. The Boneyard Club.
Yeah.
Is this a club that wouldn't want me to have me as a member?
It's a club that every cool person should be part of.
Oh, that's what I mean.
Yeah. It's just starting out because Boneyard itself doesn't have a tasting room at the moment, so it's all done mostly wholesale. There's sometimes where it'll be sold at Tarara Winery, but the real way to get your hands on most of the stuff is through the club, which does have a maximum amount of people that we're allowed to or able to put in the first couple of years, just as we build up our inventory. But it's the best way of getting all of the different wines in which Boneyard makes. And there's some of them that are such small volumes that is really the only way that they'll ever be
so
seen.
So, like, when you say small volume, like, how much? Like, how many cases?
I mean, we'll do some that are, like, 50 cases, 100 cases.
Okay.
You know, tiny production, just choosing a couple of barrels of our favorite stuff. And instead of putting it into a bigger blend, you know, we can hoard it. Mm-hmm. And part of the concept towards that is it gives me an opportunity to drink stuff that, you know, I didn't want to blend away.
Right.
So I join the club, and what happens? Do I get my wine by mail?
You can get it either by mail. We ship to 19 different states.
Can you ship into Maryland? I can't remember.
Yes, we can. Yeah, cool. Maryland passed laws of two years ago to allow that, and we got our license for it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, in all of the D.C.
hell, you know, marijuana is going to be legal soon. You might as well be able to ship me my wine.
That's right. So, yeah, I mean, we could ship all the D.C. metro area we can absolutely ship to. Mm-hmm. Actually, California is a big area for us. We ship a lot of wine to California, which I find strange, but cool.
That is so funny.
Florida's big for us. So, yeah, it's...
Okay, so how many different wines are you producing under the Boneyard label?
There's 8 wines this year.
And so what are they?
There's the unrefined series, so that's like the blends, the entry-level blends. There's unrefined red, white, and rosé. Mm-hmm. We've got Syrah, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Skins, which is that orange-style wine,
right.
Bad to the Bone Bubbles, and a Chardonnay.
Now, the prestige bottlings that you mentioned, what's the story there?
That's the Syrah, and it's because, quite frankly, I mean, winemakers, we love wine, but we can't afford a lot of the top wines all over the world. So I've always had my eye on certain styles of Syrah that, you know, I just can't normally get. And we have a block in our vineyard that's really cool and is given this delicious Syrah. So, you know, we did 38 months barrel aged on that, going more along the line of some of the single vineyard Northern Rhone stuff that I idolize but just can't have. And I figured, well, let's try to make it. And
cool.
So we're having a good time with that. And that's the prestige bottle to come out of the first.
All right. So we got about a minute. Make sure people know how to find Tarara online and the Boneyard Club.
Yeah. Tarara is pretty easy. Just www.tarara.com, TARARA.com. Mm-hmm. You can find us Facebook and Twitter and all that kind of fun stuff. Boneyard Wines, same thing. It's boneyardwines.com. Mm-hmm. You know, same thing.
Should
Twitter,
we say,
Facebook.
If you can't spell Boneyard, you can't join the club? Is that?
Yeah, it's one of the rules to it. Yeah.
All right, great. Well, so now the only way you can get that wine is through the club, correct?
Through the club. There's a couple wines that'll be available online to purchase.
Okay.
You know, the online store will be up hopefully in the next month or so. In the meantime, you can just email at info@boneyardwines.com and say, hey, I want this stuff, and we'll work it out.
Excellent. All right, Jordan thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you so much.
All right, this is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We got more. We'll be right back.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
Shepherd's Table, one of the area's leading organizations of providing basic human services to people without homes, will be hosting its annual fundraiser, Always Room for One More, live at the Fillmore on Sunday, March 30th from 3 to 7 p.m. Join Shepherd's Table for an afternoon of fun. Enjoy live and silent auctions, terrific food, beverages, and live entertainment. Three bands will perform, including Prefab Four, a Beatles tribute band from New York. For tickets, visit shepherdstable.org.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Oh, sorry, I was drinking. We're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis.
You should sing it like Beyonce.
And now we're... What?
That's her song. I've been drinking.
Oh, sorry.
Right?
I still call her Beyonce, okay, so that's well, all right. I'm old school. Mm-hmm. So Amanda Moniz is a PhD baker. Mm-hmm. She's a historian and former chef, and she somehow figured out how to dovetail her passion for baking and for her interest in history and her culinary history blog, mm-hmm. which is called History's Just Desserts. And she's going to be teaching a course at the Hill Center in June. Actually, there's one in April we can talk about, too. But in June, called the Civil War Sanitary Fair Cookbooks. And so we should really start at the start. In the Civil War period, in the antebellum period, they didn't use the word sanitary the way we use it. They didn't view it the way we view it, did they?
Right. Sanitary referred sort of broadly to healthful conditions. There was a concern about promoting the healthful condition of troops, which entailed hospital conditions, although we know, obviously, Civil War hospitals were actually places right. where disease really spread. But there was a concern to make them more healthful, but also providing clothes and blankets and towels and food for the troops. Everything yeah. referring to their bodily welfare.
The guy's lying there with sepsis in his wound, they'd open right. the window right. to make the place sanitary. So then there were these, the U.S. Sanitary Commission was formed at the beginning of the war to generally promote these quote-unquote healthful conditions. So how did that roll out to the – and it was a way of the public getting involved in the war effort, right?
That's right. Lincoln established it in 1861. There was some ambivalence. Military folks didn't necessarily want civilians involved in the battlefield or in battlefield hospitals. But there was a great outpouring of civilian support for the war in the Union. And there were comparable developments in the South, too. So the Sanitary Commission was established so that civilians could raise funds and provide goods and provide volunteer service, nursing and whatnot to help the troops.
Right. So how did they go about raising funds? I mean, how did they get people involved to go about raising funds?
There was a long tradition of fundraising fairs that had begun early in the 19th century, and this was something that had come from England to the United States. They were used for all sorts of charitable activities and for causes like the abolition cause. In the Civil War, people started holding fundraising fairs to raise funds for the U.S. Sanitary Commission.
Now, anybody listening would say, okay, what's that got to do with food? But this is cookbooks. Were really a key. They started to leverage people's interest in having recipes. And
so how did they put these together?
So the first American charity cookbook was published in 1864 for this Philadelphia Grand Fair, which was held in June of 1864, making this June the 150th anniversary. And a woman named Maria Moss, we don't know a lot about her, but she'd written a cookbook earlier, and I don't know if she hadn't been able to find a publisher or just hadn't gotten it published yet. She decided to dedicate it to the Sanitary Commission, to this Philadelphia Grand Fair. So it was published to raise funds for the fair. You could buy everything at the fair, though. You could buy food, you could buy all sorts of goods, there were entertainment, music, all sorts of things. And one of the things that was sold was this cookbook.
And so she put together the cookbook. It wasn't like a compilation of different people's recipes.
Right. These were her recipes.
Okay. They were all her recipes. And what kind of recipes were popular back then?
Well, her cookbook is geared towards people, families of some means. She has recipes for things like pancakes and muffins and, you know, more sort of everyday basic stuff. But she also has some more elegant fare. She has things like perch with white wine. She has a roasted sturgeon recipe. She has some things like oyster loaves, which were little rolls stuffed with oyster stuffing, apple charlotte. Those are a couple of things I'll be making.
So was this really geared toward people on the Eastern Seaboard where they had oysters?
I mean, oysters were shipped all over the country.
Even then?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Amazing. Yes.
So was this the poetical cookbook?
Yeah. So her cookbook is called The Poetical Cookbook.
Okay. And what made it poetical?
She precedes each recipe with a poem, and then she gives the recipe.
Roses are red, violets are blue. I like this dish. You'll like it, too.
Something like that.
Thank you very much.
But so was this the start of a trend of fundraising?
Yes, it was a start. It's not a start of a start of the trend of using charity cookbooks to fundraise, So several months later, at the end of 1864, people in Bangor, Maine published another sanitary fare cookbook, and that's been republished by a Civil War museum in Bangor. Mm-hmm. And over the next decades, over 3,000 cookbooks were published. By 1922, there were 3,000 charity and community cookbooks that had been published in
the
United States.
So who was buying the cookbooks? Mostly women?
I don't know if women or men. They were geared to women to use. Sure. You know, men may have bought them for their wives.
Because that's when men and the women knew it, right?
Yeah. I don't know what that means. Anyway.
We've somehow lost control.
Okay. But it is fascinating because even today, I mean, that is still a way that, you know, people raise funds. You know, they put together compilation cookbooks, whether it's a group of chefs or a group of, you know, ladies who lunch or whatever, you know, women's groups, things of that nature. It's amazing that it started during the Civil War as a way to do things.
Right.
Now, let's talk about the class that you're going to be doing. You have two classes coming up at the Hill Center. Let's talk about them.
I have six over the course of the year. The first was in February, and that looked at the first two African-American cookbooks. So then in April, I have one coming up that looks at Dolly Madison's famous parties, some of the foods she made. She was famous for serving cakes and desserts and sweets, as well as other food, but particularly famous for sweets. So we'll be looking at both the kinds of foods that were served at her parties and the way she used parties to political ends.
How did she use parties for political ends?
She was like the first lobbyist.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she. One thing was that she wanted to create a sense of national loyalty. You know, a lot of people in the post-revolutionary era and even well up to the Civil War had more loyalty to their state than to the country. Mm-hmm. And so her parties
were... You
have
that now.
Yeah, right.
Hello, Rick Perry.
So her parties were a way to focus attention on the nation and create senses of nationalism and to use patronage politics. She used her parties...
All right. I want to jump in because we only have a couple more minutes.
Okay.
You were a baker by trade. You worked for Mario Batali up in New... How did you make what epiphany did you have that melded these two influences?
That is sort of what it was. Just several months ago, it occurred to me I could combine my pastry background and my history background. I'd always thought I'd just left pastry behind and cooked behind professionally, and that, you know, it had sort of been a few years before I really started my career. And then it occurred to me the two could reinforce each other.
I think it's so fascinating.
Yeah. I want a re-career.
Okay. So let's tell everybody when your class is in April and when your class is in June.
The April classes are, there are two time slots, April 26th and April 30th. Mm-hmm. And the June ones are June 14th and June 19th. And you can go to the Hill Center website or to my blog, History
is
Just
it
Now, are they just lecture classes? Are you
baking? No, they're hands-on.
Hands-on.
I expect people to roll up their sleeves and to get to work.
So you will be baking during the class?
We make a few recipes in each class, and then we talk about some of the history.
Fantastic.
Now, is it hillcenter.com or something else?
It's hillcenterdc.com.
.org. I think you're right. We've had them in before. I mean, they do such fantastic things down there. They really do.
And it is a Civil War era building, so it's a particularly special place for the June class.
No. Yeah, it's very cool.
Amanda Moniz, you do some cool stuff. Actually, you're Dr. Amanda Moniz, aren't you?
That is exactly right.
You got yourself that PhD.
That is right.
All right, cool. All right.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Break time.
Is it break time?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not.
Isn't it?
No,
it's not.
We're not taking a break.
We're not,
Michael.
Come on up.
Oh
yeah. All right. So what do I know?
I'm just an
amateur doing radio.
That's exactly what it is.
All right. So Michael Sapienza is the executive director of the Chris for Life Colon Cancer. Foundation. I knew it was a nonprofit, and he visits us every year during Colon Cancer Awareness.
Well, last year and this year.
Well, that's every year to me. I can't remember back. Who are you? Let's talk about. Let's get down to the nitty gritty. So colon cancer.
So are we playing trivia first? Is that what we're going to do?
Let's talk a little bit about the problem.
Okay. So I think both of you know this, and Dave, you've said you're a colonoscopy expert, but colon cancer is the second leading.
Let me clarify. They've just gone up my butt a couple of times to look for stuff.
Okay. So colon cancer is actually the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths, and actually here in D.C. we're ranked number one for lives lost. Pretty much year after year after year. So one of the things that Chris for Life does is we want to spread the message about early screening and detection. And for those of you that don't know, and we're going to play trivia in a minute, this foundation was created in memory of my mom, and we're actually about to celebrate our four-year anniversary on March 23rd.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So let's talk about all the things you're going to do. Like the entire month you have events planned to help create awareness about colon cancer. Talk about the events that you're going to be doing.
Yeah, so last week we actually launched our Love Your Butt campaign on the Today Show on Saturday.
Wow.
So this is now a national campaign to get people talking about their butts, to get people talking about colorectal cancer screening.
Why? What's your problem?
Yeah, talk
you're
about
like,
your butt
like
all
a
the
child.
Time.
I swear to God.
I know, I am 12.
Like, she's a butt.
But this is what we kind of want. It's actually a good thing because, you know, in the early 80s, people didn't talk about their breasts, right? Nobody's, we couldn't even say the word breast.
Right.
You know, and now, luckily, we've made huge increases in the amount of women that are getting screened and getting their mammograms.
Right.
You know, but for colon cancer, we're still, you know, around 60% of people. So one in three people that are of age to get screened are still not getting screened.
But can we talk about for 2 seconds how easy a colonoscopy is?
Sure.
Because I was very squeamish about it at the beginning. You go in, they knock you out, you wake up, you get up, and you go home. It's nothing. And all the other stuff that happens, you're out cold. And meanwhile, you find out because they find polyps that are precancerous. And if they sit in there and they don't take them out, you're going to die of colon rectal cancer, period.
Yeah. I always say this. My mom was 56 when she was diagnosed. She had never had a colonoscopy.
Wow.
And if she had, she would be here today. So it's one of the reasons why I obviously, promote and advocate so much. And, Dave, you said as I walked in, there's a reason why Michael Jackson was addicted to propofol, because it is pretty amazing
sleep.
Greatest
thing in the world, as long as you don't abuse it. You go down, you come up, there's no nausea, there's no nuttiness. You literally get off the table.
Yeah.
Go about your business.
All right, well, let's play a little trivia. So why don't you ask us some questions? Everybody can participate who's in studio. Let's see how well we know what we're supposed to be doing.
Well, I have the answers in front of me. So
you can't cheat.
Okay.
So I think doing that, we're drinking cocktails. The first question I'm going to ask is, what can people do to reduce their risk of colorectal cancer? So it's A, get 150 minutes of exercise, B, limit your alcohol consumption, and C, limit intake of red and processed meats. So what's the answer?
I don't know. All?
Yes, all.
Okay, thank
all.
You. Yay, I know the answer.
And just so everybody knows, it is two or more drinks a day, so we're actually good right
okay,
now.
We're good.
So,
we just have two.
I hope Foodie and the Beast won't give you colorectal cancer for that.
Okay.
All right, let's see. So maybe another food question. Eating foods containing dietary fiber significantly decreases your risk of colon cancer. So which of the following contains the most dietary fiber?
Oh, okay.
A glass of milk, a really tough piece of meat, or a red bell pepper?
Red bell pepper.
Yes. Good.
God, Nikki, you're amazing.
I know. Come on, give me another one. I'm doing well. Let's go.
So, okay.
I didn't know she was this smart when I married her. Holy cow.
How about how many grams of fiber in a medium-sized apple?
Seven.
Four.
Yes, you're right.
I knew that. I knew that before.
I think we did talk about that.
This is how
last
I got
year.
Through chemistry in high school, by the way. Thank you.
All right, let's do another one.
Okay, so if you're a person of average risk, at what age do you start getting screened for colon cancer?
50.
40.
50.
Nope. Nikki, you're right.
And what does that mean? Nikki, it's Nikki.
Nikki.
What does of average risk mean?
So if you're African-American, you're at increased risk. So that would be age 45. If okay. you're like me and you've lost a family member to colorectal cancer, 40. You're right, Dave.
Partially right.
Yeah. So okay. And then if say, for example, you have a relative that has been diagnosed under the age of 50, say they were diagnosed at 35 and you mm-hmm. have kids, that person should get a screen 10 years prior to when they
All
were
right,
diagnosed.
Watch this. Without naming names, how many people in this room, at the other guests and all, have had a colonoscopy? Look at that.
But we're all under 50.
Doesn't matter. I went at 40 because, you know what? I think 50 is baloney because, no. You think you can't have a polyp in your intestines from all the stuff you're eating and everything at 40?
Yeah. So one of the things that we
wait,
do.
I'm going to.
Sure.
We're going to get back to you.
Okay.
We are, but we have to take a quick break. All right. We're going to learn more about loving our butts. This is David and Nikki Nellis from Foodie and the Beast. We'll be back in just a sec.
NASA needs men and women like you to participate in a program that helps study the physical changes an astronaut might encounter during microgravity conditions of spaceflight. Currently, a countermeasure and functional testing study is being done within the heads-down tilt bedrest program called CFT-70. For more information on participating in the CFT-70 program, contact the Johnson Space Center's Human Test Subject Facility at 1-866-JCS-TEST. Or visit thebedreststudy.com.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
At UPS, we take two things very seriously, your budget and our planet. It's why we've built one of the largest alternative fuel fleets in the industry. It's why we offer eco-responsible services like carbon-neutral shipping and carbon impact analysis. It's also why businesses trust UPS to provide customized solutions that cut costs and boost productivity. UPS is committed to helping you operate more efficiently and sustainably. Learn more at ups.com/gov.
Are you ready to race for impact? Are you ready to race for the cure? Join Susan G. Komen Global Race for the Cure this Mother's Day weekend on the National Mall. Saturday, May 10th marks the 25th anniversary of the Susan G. Komen Global Race for the Cure events in Washington, D.C., with fun for the whole family, including a race just for kids, everyone can help fund life-saving breast cancer screenings, treatment, and more. Register today at globalraceforthecure.org. That's globalraceforthecure.org.
We're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis, and we're talking with Michael Sapienza about...
our butts.
Butt health. Do you like my butt?
No? You don't have a butt.
I do have a butt.
Not really. Like flat.
Like cottage cheese, I know.
It's
oh, Lord.
But having said that, let's talk about butt health.
Okay.
Yeah, so what I was about to say before the break was that young people are unfortunately being diagnosed more and more. We've had about a 2% increase every year for the past 10 years okay. for people under the age of 50. So, you know,
is this people being screened?
People being diagnosed with colon
okay.
cancer.
Okay.
So, you know, Christopher Life, we see, you know, hundreds of people under the age of 50 that are diagnosed and unfortunately that pass from the disease. So, mm-hmm. you know, Dave was saying we should make the screening age 40, but unfortunately that's not really our decision. I mean, we're advocating for things like that, but what I would say is if we can make people aware, young people aware, is if you know, if you do have cramps, if you have, you know, bleeding in your stool, or if you have night sweats or any of those sorts of things, make sure you're an advocate for yourself when you go mm-hmm. into your doctor. And mm-hmm. if they're telling you to take Metamucil or something, no, mm-hmm. say, you know what, I want to get a colonoscopy because, okay. you know, what often happens is that someone will feel a tumor and they'll be diagnosed later stage when they're younger because they haven't, you know, been properly screened.
Guess who's going in for a colonoscopy? Yeah. Nikki Nellis.
Okay.
Yes, sirree.
Well, let's talk about...
Wait, we only have a couple more minutes. I want to ask a question.
We have several minutes.
Is our diet... promoting colon cancer?
Yeah, so colon cancer is mainly a Western disease.
Okay.
So places like India, China, Africa, those sorts of places actually have a very, very low incidence of colon cancer, colorectal mm-hmm. cancer. But it's actually on the increase because of the introduction of Western processed foods.
Okay.
So, you know, we talked about this already, but a diet high in fiber, mm-hmm. a diet low in red meat, you know, a lifestyle that is sedentary obviously is going to increase your risk. So exercise. So those are the things that are actually correlate with colorectal cancer. It's hard to say, you know, does McDonald's, you know, cause colon cancer? No. I mean, we probably can't.
They should put it on the menu.
Right.
You
know,
we can't say that, but we can say that, you know, lots of red and processed meats and a diet high in fiber can help.
Well, so we were talking off air. I was saying that there seems to be this uptick in people getting diagnosed with Crohn's disease and colitis. I feel like you hear more and more children and adults getting diagnosed with these diseases. What is the correlation with colon cancer and those diagnoses?
I don't know the medical correlation, mm-hmm. but I do know that if you have Crohn's or you have colitis, or you have any sorts of problem like that, that it is you need to be screened earlier. So you should be getting screened at 40, mm-hmm. if not earlier, if you have either of those symptoms.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the events you're doing this
sure.
week, because you've got a huge one coming up on March 17th.
Yeah, so March 17th is our second annual Eat for Life event, which mm-hmm. is a chef challenge. Last year, Scott Druneau won the challenge.
Shocking. That's
yeah.
shocking.
And he's coming back again. And then we also have our Carlos Gonzalez from Pinstripes and Frederic Depew from Table DC, Alan Javery from Copperwood Tavern. And I think we have one other one that is going to be a surprise, but hasn't been announced yet. But basically what the event is all about is to promote colon cancer prevention, mm-hmm. and healthy foods, similar to what we're talking about. So we provide the chefs actually a list of ingredients, of colon-friendly ingredients, and then they cook them.
Cool. And anybody can go to this event?
Anybody can go, yeah. It's chrisforlife.org/eatforlife.
Okay.
And four is the number, don't spell it out.
Yep.
Chris for Life.
Yep.
All right, cool.
Great.
Michael, thanks.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. That was really terrific.
Okay, and I'll let you know when her colonoscopy is scheduled.
We'll announce it on air.
All right, let's get back
to
you.
Who did that? Didn't somebody do it on
Katie
air?
Couric.
Yeah, I'll do Katie Couric.
We'll do her colonoscopy on air. Won't that be exciting?
Yeah.
All right, Brenda,
no,
let's go back to you. You got a last drink teed up there.
I do. This one's called the Short Mexican Stiffy.
That's a great name. I love that. I think
that's a different show, Brenda.
I'm very literal with my naming. It's in a short glass. Everything in it is Mexican, and it's a stiff drink. So
okay, there we go.
Everybody should get their minds out of the gutter, please. And
I'll add ice
to this one. And it's good because this one is the strongest. So, you know, if everybody's, you know.
What does a stiff drink mean? What does that mean?
There's three different kinds of alcoholic drinks. There's a stiff drink, there's a strong drink, or a medium or a long drink. So a stiff one would be a spirit with just a little bit of syrup and maybe some bitters to chop the edges off.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be mostly spirit. A strong one is about half and half. If you think of a whiskey sour or a daiquiri,
okay,
a little bit of sugar and some juice, usually citrus, and then spirit, so it's about half and half. And mm-hmm. then the other, the last one is long, so that's a highball. It's about two part mixer and one part spirit.
So of the drinks you made today, what do we got?
I'd say the margarita is on the stiffer side of strong,
right?
And then sangria. Got some rum in there.
Applause meters.
Right, right. It's kind of a strong.
Yeah, it's strong. That's strong. And this one is stiff.
Okay, good. So, I'm glad to know now. I got the lingo right.
That's very good.
Okay, so we only have a minute or two left. Can you talk a little bit about the cuisine at El Rey, like what they're serving there and how the cocktails go with?
The tacos, the pescado right now, the beef taco, the fish taco are my two favorites.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to do mass appeal with the sangria and the margarita, and I just think they go together.
Sure.
And they have a natural affinity. Tacos
and you also have a beer program there, don't you?
Correct. Yeah, we do. We've got Pacifico on Dos Equis and Negra Modelo on draft, and then a few, to span the styles of beer and a few local picks.
All right, let's make sure you tell people where to find El Rey.